All right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. And this is actually, it's really amazing that I'm here on time today. I got to tell you, there's something psychotic about me that I know if I left the house 15 minutes earlier, I would have no trouble getting here. But I always rely on the sanity and the good driving skills of the people on the highway, and I'm always betrayed. And it's like, I know, it's like when I was a kid, my mother kept telling me, don't put your hand in that fire. And I would keep, she says, you'll get burnt. And I would keep doing it and keep doing it until I discovered electric plugs. And then I started doing that. Therefore, that explains why my hair looks the way it does. All right. And this is the Michael Slate Show, and we've got a great show for you today. On the back end of the show, we are going to be invaded by the notorious, the nefarious, the ever-present, all-present, big and mighty, powerful and mighty, whatever it is, Mr. Fish, a.k.a. Dwayne Booth. And Mr. Fish, I have something to tell you. I think I found out where you got your name, but we'll talk about that when you're on the show. At the back end of the show, we're going to spend quite a bit of time with Mr. Fish. Really looking forward to that. And he's going to be joining us to talk about his life, his work, his loves, his dreams, his hopes, his sadnesses, all of that, and what gets brought out in his political cartooning. But opening the show up, a very serious, serious subject. You know, it's just recently, there has been a huge hunger strike at the Guantanamo torture chamber. And we've had some coverage of it over a period of time. And we had a show with Andy Worthington a little while ago. And but it's continued to develop. And it's mammoth. It's monumental. It's unprecedented in a certain way in terms of what's actually happening on a world scale here. And joining us to talk about that today will be Omar Farah from the Center for Constitutional Rights. And Omar is one of the attorneys for he's a staff attorney for the Guantanamo Global Justice Initiative, and he's represented prisoners in numerous court cases since 2008. And he's also the attorney for a few of the detainees at Guantanamo. And he's going to be talking with us about the strike, what's going on with it, and what's happening with it. The Center for Constitutional Rights has led the legal battle over Guantanamo for the last 11 years, representing clients in two Supreme Court cases and organizing and coordinating hundreds of pro bono lawyers across the country, ensuring that nearly all of the men detained at Guantanamo have had the option of legal representation. Among other Guantanamo cases, the center represents the families of men who died at Guantanamo and men who have been released and are seeking justice in international courts. And in addition, CCR has been working through diplomatic channels to resettle men who remain at Guantanamo because they cannot return to their country of origin for fear of persecution and torture. And Omar joined the Center for Constitutional Rights in 2012 as a staff attorney. And I'm really happy to welcome him to the show today. Omar, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sure. Let's just jump right into this because I think, you know, there's just so much, as I was saying, and I want to spend quite a bit of time. So feel free to be as, you know, into detail as you want. I think people really need to understand what's happening in Guantanamo, what's going on, what's the significance of it, and why the hell they should be out in the streets with pitchforks and torches demanding an end to all this. So CCR has said that there's a grave crisis unfolding at Guantanamo. In broad strokes, can you give us a sense of what that is?
Well, there's an immediate crisis, and that's the hunger strike that that I can describe. There's a broader crisis, which you touched on very well in your opening, which is the profound uncertainty and torment that the men are enduring that's been produced by 11 years of indefinite detention without charge or trial. But to take the immediate crisis first, under the pretext of searching for improvised weapons, the Department of Defense in February resumed the practice of searching the pages and the binding of the prisoners' Qurans. And this is something that we've heard consistently from every prisoner who's managed to have access to his counsel since the hunger strike began. And that's something that the Department of Defense knows from the prisoner's viewpoint constitutes desecration of their holy book and is uniquely provocative and in some senses, you know, senselessly brought about the risk that the current hunger strike would unfold. That was the triggering event. But what fuels the hunger strike now into its third month is this broader tragedy that after 11 years and after near unanimity in the American political spectrum that Guantanamo should be closed back in 2008, the branches of our government, all three branches, have largely slammed the door on the fate of these men, and they recognize that they're facing potentially forever in Guantanamo. They're facing growing old and dying in the prison just because, you know, the administration has turned away from its promise to close the prison. And I know from sitting at Guantanamo and meeting with men, sitting across the table from them, that, you know, the prospect of that, the prospect of never seeing their loved ones again, despite having never been charged with a crime or tried, is utterly devastating.
Devastating and enraging for anyone who actually has a heart and a head. You know, it's just incredibly. Anyway, one of the things that you said that in terms of precipitating this, you know, the assault around the Quran and other things, and the idea of searching for hidden weapons. They also, you know, one of the things that it seems the authorities have done continuously they've been trying to sort of cast the crisis in different terms. For instance, even now, one of the things that I've been reading more or less consistently has been that, well, actually what we were searching the Qurans for was the fact that some of these prisoners are getting ready to kill themselves by taking overdoses of antipsychotic drugs, and they're hiding them in the binding of the Quran. And that's all we're doing, is trying to save their life. But when you talk about what's actually going on here, and I think it's very important what you've been bringing out about the bigger context of this, because it is, you know, it's incredible when you think about this, and 166 people that are there, and how many of them have already been approved for release but are sitting there, no charges, no trial, and no release date, even though they've already been approved. But the government is constantly trying to make it seem that they're operating in the interests of the prisoners themselves and not in the interests of stopping this very, very powerful expression of opposition and dissent in relation to what's happening to the prisoners there.
Yeah, everything the Department of Defense does, according to them, is for the benefit of the prisoners. You know, just over the weekend, you know, within hours after the International Committee of the Red Cross left Guantanamo after having done their inspection, the base commander ordered a pre-dawn raid of Camp 6, which is the primary detention facility, to lock it down, to break up the hunger strikers, move them into solitary confinement-like cells, and in the process, fired on them with at least 4 non-lethal rounds. The Department of Defense spokesperson said that this was done for the prisoners' well-being, in order to create a way for them to be effectively monitored while they're on hunger strike. So it doesn't surprise me that the government's view is that searching the pages of the prisoners' Qurans was done for their benefit. But let me just say a broader point, because it's an important one about the significance of the Quran searches. I represent a man named Fahad Ghazi. He's a young man, arrived at Guantanamo as a teenager about 9 months after he graduated high school. He's about to turn 29 years old. That's how long he's been there. Mm. And he was explaining to me, and he said, you know, the reason that the Quran searches are so helpful to the prisoners is that it's really the one thing that they have to sort of help them get through this ordeal. You know, they don't have much else at the prison, and it's their most, for many of them, the most cherished thing that they have. And they view if the Department of Defense can, it's respectful to that, to their holy book, then what's left? What regard do they have for the prisoners' lives themselves? And so this is a broader point to sort of contextualize why it's such a provocative thing for the Department of Defense to do. And they know that from, you know, more than a decade managing the prison, they know full well how the prisoners view that. Mm-hmm. But you're right that the broader, you know, you can't separate the triggering event from its broader context. And the Department of Defense and the government has been working very hard to create the perception that all is well at Guantanamo. And because the flow of information from the prison is so controlled, for instance, you can't have a phone call with Fahad Ghazi, my client, even though he's fluent in English and could explain his situation far better than I could. You can't contact him. You can't speak to him. And so it's pretty easy for the Department of Defense to create the perception for many Americans that, you know, it's a state-of-the-art facility and all is well. And, of course, that can't possibly be the truth after 11 years. And this hunger strike, I think, is a very powerful cry to all of us who have our freedom to stop and take a look and recognize the horror that these men are facing. Here's the thing. There's a perception that torture has ended at Guantanamo, and some of the most obvious forms have. But the fact that we are so comfortable with the current status quo, I think, is largely a failure of our ability to sort of comprehend what's really going on there. All of your listeners can imagine what it would be like to be beaten up by someone more powerful. We can conceive of, you know, the kind of humiliation we would feel if we were stripped naked in front of other people. It's very difficult for people who have their freedom to get their mind around the prospect of indefinite detention, perhaps for the rest of your life, without charge or trial. It's almost impossible to conceive of what it would be like to be put in a steel and concrete cell and not told when, if ever, you'd be released. And the fact that we struggle so mightily to comprehend the suffering that these men are enduring, I think, has contributed to a lot of the silence around Guantanamo. And that's why this hunger strike is such an important turning point. Mm-hmm. I think many of us are now finally stopping and recognizing exactly what the true nature of the injustices at Guantanamo.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Omar Farah from the Center for Constitutional Rights, an attorney who is actively involved in defending, in fighting for the interests of the detainees at Guantanamo, and is representing one of the detainees in the prison now. And tell me this, Omar, you were talking about the impact of the hunger strike, and then you mentioned this point about the government's explanation. You know, you mentioned the point about the assault, the military assault, the attempt to what seems to be an attempt to really, you know, intimidate and possibly crush whatever, you know, the hunger strike, and, you know, basically saying to people, look, you go up against us, this is what you're going to face. And one of the things I was wondering about was, has there been, do you see an aspect of retaliation coming into operation against the detainees for speaking out, for actually doing, for making, for pushing themselves onto the front pages of newspapers around the world, including, you know, you just recently had the UN, the High Commissioner for Human Rights, declare that this was unacceptable. What was going on in Guantanamo is unacceptable and is a clear breach of international law. Do you get a sense that the Defense Department, the government, is actually moving to retaliate against the detainees?
You know, I'm reluctant to speculate on what sort of drives the Department of Defense, but I will say that I think for sure it's in the interest of this administration, and I think this is being acted on through the Department of Defense, it's in the interest of this administration to have this issue go away. The fact that there has been such consistent and effective coverage of the tragedy unfolding at the prison only hurts this administration that has been sitting on its hands when it comes to Guantanamo policy for the last more than two years. And one of the things that, you know, and that's reflected in the way that the Department of Defense has been talking about the hunger strike. You know, they're not saying anything about the underlying injustice that's fueling it. They're characterizing it as a sort of shallow attempt by the prisoners with their lawyers in cahoots to get media attention. And there's two things wrong with that. One, it's not true. And two, you can't really fault the prisoners for wanting the world to recognize exactly the kind of suffering that they've been enduring. So I think part of what you're seeing now is an attempt to silence the prisoners and to put a lid on this really tragic story. And one of the reasons why the decision to move the prisoners into solitary confinement-like cells is such a damaging one for the prisoners' interest is, one, they can't see or interact with each other, monitor each other, help each other, but also it prevents them from communicating to their lawyers what they're seeing across the prison camps.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a very powerful but unfortunate way to silence the reports that we've been getting from the prison.
Let me bring in to join the conversation Andy Worthington. He's a journalist and co-founder of the site CloseGuantanamo.org. And Andy's been covering Guantanamo from the very beginning. Andy, welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi, Michael.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, Emma.
Hi, Andy. Nice to hear your voice.
Yeah, and you.
Andy, tell me this. You know, there was a recent piece in the New York Times, an op-ed piece by Najee Al-Hassan Mokbel, and it was entitled "Gitmo is Killing Me." And as I read it, I thought people really need to know, have some understanding of actually the human aspect of really, what is the human aspect of this? What's happening to the detainees during in Guantanamo right now in the midst of this hunger strike? And I know you've had you've been writing about and reporting on a conversation from somebody whose case you followed for a long time and fought for his, you know, release and whatnot, is Shakar Amer. And you've had a conversation, you reported on a conversation he had with his attorney about the conditions that people are facing now. Can you tell us a little bit about the condition, the hunger strike, and what are the conditions that people are facing right now?
Well, you know, I mean, I think actually you and Omar have been covering very effectively what's happening now and how the administration is trying to shut down the hunger strike by isolating the prisoners. If you consider how many years they've been held, you know, without charge or trial, and, you know, and this is what's driving their despair. For the men who have been able to mix with each other for certainly, you know, some of the last few years, under the way the Obama administration kind of opened things up a little bit, for them to be slammed into solitary at this particular time, I'm finding it hard to understand what kind of horrible impact that's going to have on them. You know, all of this seems to be the administration evading the responsibility of dealing with it on the basis, not on the basis of the trouble within Guantanamo, but on the basis of why the prisoners have so desperately been trying to get the world's attention and why they have, I'm glad to say, succeeded in doing it. So, you know, all the details of the day-to-day abuse and humiliations, which have always been part of Guantanamo's history, you know, they are important. But I think what's most important is that we've been hearing from the prisoners directly. And this is something of a unique development. And I'm hoping that Omar isn't going to tell us that they've stopped the prisoners communicating with their lawyers in this manner. Because, you know, traditionally what happened at Guantanamo was that every word that took place between the prisoners and their lawyers was presumptively classified. Then there would be a Pentagon review board, a censorship board, would decide what could be unclassified and not. And what's been happening recently, as with that New York Times op-ed by Samir, is that the prisoners have been talking to their lawyers on phone calls, and the lawyers have been able to tell these stories to the world almost directly. And it seems to me that suddenly, for the first time, people in large numbers are realizing that these are human beings and that they have stories. And that their stories not only say that these people, you know, many of them have been cleared for release, they don't appear to be what they've been sold to them as these dangerous people, that these are human beings. I think that's very important what's happening there. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that's the most significant thing that's been happening about this. And the government's way of clamping down, like I say, I just find absolutely appalling. What needs to happen and what we absolutely need to keep hammering away at the administration for is for action, is for releasing people that the government says it doesn't want to hold, for not obstinately refusing to deal with this, which, as Omar said, is absolutely what the Obama administration has been doing for the last 2 years.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Omar Farah from the Center for Constitutional Rights and one of the attorneys for the Guantanamo detainees, and Andy Worthington, a regular guest on this show, and he's an author and journalist and co-founder of the site CloseGuantanamo.org. Omar, tell me this. Andy just brought up the idea, the question about the communication between the lawyers and their clients. You know, has there been any attempt to interfere with that? And for instance, I just read in Harper's just recently that Scott Horton revealed that there has been a study from Seton Hall that revealed that a lot of the supposedly confidential conversations between attorneys and the people who are currently facing the military tribunal down there in Guantanamo, that those conversations are being recorded and listened in on. Has there been any kind of attempt to interfere with the confidential communications between you and your client or other attorneys and their clients?
Well Andy started to describe the regime that governs my communications with my clients and the others at Guantanamo Bay. That remains in effect. You're right that the military commissions is, you know, took another devastating blow to its legitimacy through those revelations. But just to be, so your listeners are clear, it's still the case that anything a prisoner says at Guantanamo is presumptively classified. If I have a meeting and my client says, you know, I'm not feeling too well today, that's classified national security information until I surrender my notes to a review team that then determines whether or not that can be revealed publicly or not. That remains the case. And so there are The regime of secrecy persists at Guantanamo. That remains the case from President Bush on to President Obama, and so there is a logistical challenge in bringing these prisoners' stories to light. And I think Andy is spot on that the missing component of this up until now, I mean, I think it's slightly changing, but the missing component has been the prisoners' ability to tell their own stories. And, as I said, I represent Fahed Ghazi. He's an extremely intelligent individual. He's mastered English in the time that he's been at Guantanamo. He's far more eloquent than I could ever be about what he's suffering. I believe that if he were able to speak to you the way I am now, many more of your listeners would be persuaded that Guantanamo has to be closed and closed without delay.
Mm-hmm.
It's been in the government's interest to frustrate those efforts. Part of that is just the existing regime of secrecy, but from it's also quite common for the government to take other kinds of measures. For example, there's some stories written about the identities of the prisoners who are being force-fed, that information being declared protected. I think the framing in which your listeners need to understand this is that the primary interest, as far as I can tell, from the Senate administration is to have this story and the whole fiasco of Guantanamo simply go away, because there is no political will on the part of the Obama administration to actually do anything about it. And so as long as we're talking about the tragedy unfolding, we're going to be pressed to ask what precisely is this president doing about it. And when that answer is absolutely nothing, the interest of the administration is organized around turning our attention to some other subject, and that we can't afford to have happen, because quite literally men's lives are hanging in the balance.
So this hunger strike actually, I mean, the importance of it actually in terms of being a kick in the ass to the attempt to suppress a lot of the public exposure of what's going on in Guantanamo, this has really been a kick in the ass to the efforts of the Defense Department and the government. And it seems to me, I read recently too, that apparently civilian flights have been curtailed. And that when reporters get there, when the press gets there, that actually there's very, very strict limits on what they're able to do, what they're able to see, not even allowed to take pictures of banners that prisoners might hang out there over the fence or whatever, and with statements on it. Is this something that's new since the hunger strike?
No, you're commenting on it's sort of an odd event that has now been resolved, but it did look like the one charter flight that carries private attorneys like myself who represent the men to Guantanamo was going to be suspended. But that's now been resolved. But as far as what the press is able to see and record at Guantanamo, you're absolutely right that it's severely restricted. I mean, ultimately, there's no story at Guantanamo other than the prisoners who are there. Covering the infrastructure that's there, covering the talking points that a soldier has been told to say when he meets reporters is not a story. That's not information that's usable or meaningful, when really the issue of Guantanamo is the 166 men who have been detained there, all but a handful who've never been charged or tried, and who are increasingly whose health is deteriorating, and many of whom are now skeletal and being just devastated by the hunger strike. So unless you're actually meeting the prisoners, unless you have an opportunity to interact with them, you're really getting the usual dog and pony show from the government.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why shows like this are so important. I wish it weren't the case that I was the only way to tell my clients' stories, but so far that's largely it. And Andy is right that the piece in the New York Times was so powerful precisely because it came directly from the mouth of one of the prisoners, and that's something that those of us who are working on this issue need to do a lot more of.
Right. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Omar Farah from the Center for Constitutional Rights and one of the attorneys for the Guantanamo detainees, and Andy Worthington, a regular guest on this show, and he's an author and journalist and co-founder of the site CloseGuantanamo.org. Andy, one of the things that you've been doing, concentrating a lot on bringing as much as you can the voices of these prisoners out into the public arena. And one of the things that really struck me is when you were talking about Shachar Amar and the conversation he had with his attorney, and he revealed these new codes that are in effect in Guantanamo. And one of them was really particularly appalling, was the Code Matrix. And you report that it was used against Shocker when he refused to allow himself to allow them to attach a dog leash to him, and which brought immediately anybody reading that who is sentient has to understand that that immediately conjures up Abu Ghraib and all the kind of warped, you know, degenerate torture that has been unleashed against prisoners being held in U.S. prisons all over the world. What did you think of that when you heard that?
Well, you know, I mean, obviously, it does sound appalling in that context, and it does bring back those memories. I mean, I think the interesting angle on this, and the one that, you know, that people need to understand, the administration needs to understand, is that when this first round of horrendous abuse and torture was taking place after 9/11, primarily from 2002 to 2004 at various locations, including Abu Ghraib, there was some motivation behind that, you know, in a twisted and false way, was about actually extracting information from prisoners. It was about interrogation, or it was leading to interrogation, or that was the theory. That justification no longer exists. What it's now about is discipline. And Shaka very eloquently has been telling his story from Guantanamo over the last year, I think. I mean, I've certainly had reports from his lawyers from a year ago and have made those available, where, you know, he has been engaged in trying to tell the world about his plight and that of his fellow prisoners before the hunger strike began. You know, and that one of the ways that he was highlighting the injustice was that he was refusing to do what they told him. So when they allowed him out for recreation, he refused to come back in. So every day he got beaten up because he was making a point about not doing what he was told, because he was campaigning for his right to be treated like a human being, to be treated like any other human being deprived of their liberty, who has rights, whereas the prisoners at Guantanamo very clearly still don't actually have any rights. And, you know, and this went on all the way up until the hunger strike began. Shaka was engaged in his struggle of resistance with the authorities. The abuse that he was receiving was not because he's of any value, but simply because they want to retain order and discipline within the prison. The logic of why the prison is there disappeared with the Bush administration. And I think it's that people need to know. They need to, you know, the real player in this who is avoiding scrutiny is President Obama. He absolutely owns every square inch of this place. It is his prison. It has no purpose anymore. And yet, these people are deprived of their liberty. As Omar said, most of the men there can presume now that they will die in that place, because the president doesn't care. And, you know, that's what the American people need to know. This shame is happening now. It's in their name, and it's being upheld by President Obama.
Can I follow Andy's point? Because it's...
Absolutely.
It's such an important one to make, and the administration has been so effective at deflecting the criticism that the president deserves for his inaction on Guantanamo onto Congress. And by no means is this a defense of Congress. I mean, it's absolutely been scandalous the way that it's used Guantanamo and the annual defense appropriation bill as a vehicle to express its hostility towards plans to close the prison. But it's a terrible misperception that Congress has blocked the president's ability to close Guantanamo. It's just simply not the case. The National Defense Authorization Act imposes very severe restrictions on the use of funds to release prisoners, but it also includes a much less reported and less covered waiver that would permit the president to sidestep some of the most onerous restrictions. But what the National Defense Authorization Act does, and it's terrible but also utterly effective, has been to incrementally increase the political cost of following through on the president's plan to close Guantanamo.
Yeah.
Congress gambled that if it did that, the president would back off of his initiative. And were they ever right? The president could certify prisoners for release by issuing a waiver through the Secretary of Defense that a specific transfer was in the national security interest of the United States, for example. if you look at the criticism that the president makes of the National Defense Authorization Act, that's precisely the language he uses. He says operating Guantanamo is not in our national security interest. I mean, that language was in his very signing statement that accompanied the National Defense Authorization Act.
Yeah.
If he were sincere that that operating Guantanamo hurts national security interests, he need only turn to the provisions that are already in that law to release men like Shakir Ahmer, like my clients, like Mohammed Al-Hamiri, for example, who's been unanimously cleared for release. And yet he's never done so.
Yeah.
Not once, not even for any of the 86 prisoners who are released. And I think that is deserving of withering criticism, especially now that, as I said, you know, there are men who are skeletal at Guantanamo. There are men who are on the verge of death. You know, last year, Adnan Latif died in his cell after having been cleared for release three times. If the president had foreseen that death, would he have done anything differently? Because that's precisely the scenario that he's in now. And so far, he seems willing to turn a blind eye.
Mm-hmm. All right. And that's precisely the point I wanted to end on. Andy, I want to give you a chance at a closing comment. Anything to add to that?
Yeah, I was just going to follow up by saying the president himself is the one who imposed a ban on releasing Yemenis. He hasn't lifted that ban. He imposed it over 3 years ago in the wake of the failed airline bomb plot, the underwear bomber. You know, Adnan Latif is one of those men who died as a result of that decision in last September. The Yemenis that we've been discussing, Samir, who had the op-ed in the New York Times, the people that Omar's been talking about, all Yemenis, all cleared for release. There are nearly 60 men who Yemenis cleared for release. President Obama needs to lift that ban, and we need to tell him that he has to do it.
All right, Andy Worthington, thank you very much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thanks very much, Michael.
Okay, and Omar Farah, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for covering this. It's really important.
Sure.
Thank
well,
you.
We'll have you back, man. Take care. All right. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Omar Farah and Andy Worthington. Omar is an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights, and Andy is a journalist and filmmaker, and he's also the co-founder of the CloseGuantanamo.org site. So basically, go to CCR site, the Center for Constitutional Rights site. Find out, follow up on there. They got a whole section on what's going on in Guantanamo. And go to Andy's site, both the Andy Worthington site and the CloseGuantanamo.org. We're going to take a break, and it's going to be both a commercial break, but also it's going to be an extended musical break. And when we come back, we'll be talking with Mr. Fish. Okay, so stay tuned for that. Play it all the way through, but Mr. Fish is giving me a fish eye over here saying, I want to talk. That is just beautiful and powerful. And remember last year, Lily Hayden was on my show talking about that. And the fact that this song, which is How I Got My Brains Back, was a product of her actually getting severely ill as a result of some kind of, you know, toxic thing at her house when it was built. And she had lost her ability to play the violin, and she suddenly started playing, you know, this classical music, you know, a classical piece. And she developed this song to commemorate. She actually rebuilt her ability, and she's an amazing violin player. And she rebuilt her ability to play. And as you can tell, it's been a remarkable. Just her body of work is remarkable. Joining us now, and he just came into the studio, and he didn't follow the rules. He was supposed to press his face up against the glass and ask for permission to come in. But he just sort of balked at that, so it's going to be a rough interview. Joining us now is Mr. Fish, hey. A.K.A., as they always say, Dwayne Booth. But I'm just going to stick with Mr. Fish. How you doing, man?
I'm doing good. I didn't want to smear my lipstick on your glass is the reason I didn't press my face against it.
It doesn't matter. I clean that. That's what I do after the show is I clean the glass, okay? Now, tell me something, man. What did my first question, Mr. Fish, and I just have to know this, okay, because it sort of struck me in the middle of the night. I literally woke up, bolted up out of bed, and said, Mr. Fish, Marvel Comics. Is that where you got the name?
I did not. No, I'm actually angry that Mr. Fish exists because that is the Mr. Fish that has the Wikipedia page.
Aha! I looked that up this morning and it was yes, it's true. And there were two Mr. Fishes and now there's three Mr. Fishes. So we got a problem, Dwayne.
Well, there was the Mr. Fish, the fashion designer in England. In the 60s, too.
Boy, we got a big problem.
It gets very muddy, yeah.
We got a big problem. You're gonna have to do something. You're going to have to figure out some way to actually have one Mr. Fish, okay?
Senor Pescado. Maybe that's it.
There you go. All right. Well, welcome back, man. It's been a while since we've had you on, and it's always a pleasure. And what are you up to?
Oh, my goodness. The same nonsense. Just stoking the rage and making pretty pictures about it.
You know, I went on your site, and some of the ones you had for April were really kind of mind-blowing, and in particular, Bradley Manning.
Right.
And that one about Bradley Manning, and then you have Join the Army and Whistle While You Work.
Exactly.
Really, really cool. Very, very, very cool. What got into you around that?
You know, I'm so angry at the fact that I don't know if I've ever heard President Obama say the words Bradley Manning. And the fact that it is not one of the main issues that people talk about because it has so many far-reaching implications just for, just human rights and just in general, that great umbrella. So I think it's really important to keep that subject matter not only in the public eye, but treat it with grace and importance. You know, I mean, people are vulnerable and people deserve respect.
You know, there's something in all of your work, which we talked about before, a couple times before, but in particular, this point that you actually take aim at some of the most critical questions and some that people don't even realize are the most critical questions. You know, your work sticking pins in the eyes of Jesus are actually kind of – I kind of appreciate that. And all gods, actually. So,
right, yeah.
You know, which I kind of appreciate very much. But it's also you've taken on a kind of mission – to set the world straight, brother.
Well, it's really just trying to figure out the right conversation to have. You know, there's so many assumptions that people have that they shouldn't assume. For example, let me just talk about what's happening now. Let's talk about what's happening in Boston now. When that news broke, I knew that most of the editorial cartoonists working in this country were going to do some variation of a drawing of a bloody shoe laying on the street. While that recognizes the horror of the situation, it doesn't advance any discussion about what it means. You know, it's even this morning, I've found it very, very interesting to see how people fall over themselves trying to define what terrorism is. You know, you hear the word terrorism and so much of mainstream media, automatically it means it's coming from outside. And the fact that CNN, which they were talking about this morning, that the person they're chasing after is Muslim. They have to make that clear, but then they have to also say, we're not inferring that all Muslims are dangerous. But what are they really inferring, you know? I mean, why didn't they say he enjoyed SpongeBob when he was a younger person? You know, who else can we scapegoat? Who else can we find some sort of reason why somebody went off the deep end?
Now, this is something – well, first, let me remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Mr. Fish, Dwayne Booth. Dwayne, tell me this. You talked about – and I remember being very confused when I read your book, which was very, very confusing, okay? Because – only because you raised in there that, you know, you weren't trying to be an essayist. In fact, I've read in other places where you were actually – you summed up yourself as a failed essayist because you were writing unreadable scrolls against – railing at everything.
Yeah.
And you really honed in on your art, on your drawing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you talked about you know, not really being editorializing or anything like that, but there's a difference apparently between editorializing and political cartooning, which you've been really concentrated on a lot, including with this whole show that you had down at USC right. over the last year, which was a very powerful show. I'm going to talk a little bit more about that
okay.
and your own experience and all that. But what about that? I mean, what political cartooning, what is it that you that drives you to that? And how is it different than, for instance, editorials?
I come to it if you just think broadly about what it is. You're using imagery to express an opinion about something. You can do that with cartoons. You can also do it with oil paints. So when I realized that I have an ability to express myself visually, I started to do it and have always been doing it, and only started getting into seeing it in print when a magazine newspaper called Anarchy decided to start running me in 1990. I had no real ambition to see myself in print or become an editorial cartoonist. But then when I started to publish with Anarchy and saw that not only does it strike people from the pages of a magazine, it can be put on a T-shirt. It can be used in different ways and then inspire people to join a movement or just ask questions. You know, that's the purpose of art too. You know, it goes places in an honest way that the mainstream is not going to go. So at least it begins those conversations. So whatever labels about are you a political cartoonist, an editorial cartoonist, you know, I often feel like what Bob Dylan went through when he was trying to be pigeonholed as a protest mm-hmm. singer.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And that was very interesting to me because people often look to him as being, look, you've got a responsibility to do this, as opposed right. to he was creating his art.
And also, I mean, also with political cartoons and editorial cartoonists that appear in newspapers, usually they have to begin their drawing, like I said, assuming whatever the editorial position of the newspaper is. You know, if you're living in, say, the 1800s and you're part of the establishment, you could make an argument that slaves are better off in the 18th century than in the 17th century. And all of a sudden you find yourself saying, you know, what did the slaves have to complain about? They're a lot better off now than they were then. You find yourself not railing against slavery because I'm basically saying that in mainstream and quite often in mainstream thinking, you tend to make all of your points based on these crazy comparisons. I'm a Democrat because I'm not a Republican. You know, I'm a peacenik because I hate war. There's an underlying conversation that people should have that is much more intelligent than just those positions. Those are all very, very surface.
Now, one of the things that actually stands out with you too, though, is that you clearly, and it's interesting. So this Anarchy magazine, was that – at that point, did you decide to give up the hamburger job? Is that what happened? got screwed because they didn't pay you at Anarchy, right?
They didn't. Yeah, that was the outrage.
Odd figures, yeah. right. What are you going to do? Let me remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Mr. Fish, Dwayne Booth. Well, tell me this, because you have these cartoons, and and they're very powerful, and they are, as we've talked about before. They just snap your head, make your head snap around. You know, a lot of times, the most effective ones. And the ones that don't, just like, whoa, he can't. Whoa, is he really doing – you know, and right. a lot of people react that way. But it's very interesting to me because you are clearly – your sensibilities are to the left, okay? We'll just say that in general. It's not – you're not just sort of I'm just a humanitarian and I pet all animals and love all children and, you know, although you probably do. I'm not saying you don't. But, you know, there's a point here where you are to the left. And you know, one of the things that really, really gets me about your work is that – it's not stuck in a kind of like the large fist raised up through the, you know, in the sky or the real sort of stereotypical work, but it really causes people – you take people on sort of a mini journey, which is kind of heavy. In one panel, you just take people from here to there in a snap, you know, which is really – to me, it's very heavy.
Yeah, well, there's always a danger when you're talking about politics and you're assuming that there's going to be a large audience looking at what you do, that you tend to just become a sloganeering simplifier of the issues. I got into the habit of imagining one person generally, that I'm a friend.
Was that me?
That was you.
Okay.
Come on, give me a hug. And that's a trick of writers. I mean, generally, that's a rule for writers. Successful writers have said that it's not – you don't try to make love to the world when you write. You try to find that person And that really hones your thinking. And you, and then you can find the complications in the argument that way, because you're not forcing it through a bullhorn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Well, let's talk about that, because the exhibit, the show that you had up at USC, which included editorial cartoonists and political cartoonists from across the years, the decades and beyond, and actually it was really, you know, all the way back, you know, and it was really very, very heavy. And you mentioned to me the last time you were on that there were, you know, there were things that really inspired you in there, in particular a couple of artists. And then there's, I also want to save some time to talk about what political cartoonists actually have to face in many kinds of ways, which is censorship, repression, and suppression. So let's talk about first, just in broad strokes, the people who inspired you around these political cartoonists who inspired you.
What I was really inspired by when I started when I curated the exhibit, and now that I'm researching for an ebook that I'm working on, are the younger generation. I think that's where most of my excitement is right now. Certainly, I mean, there was stuff in the early 1900s with the newspaper The Masses and Robert Minor and many of those guys that everybody that we sort of know, but we don't know all of their stuff. So I've been finding some really great, dangerous gems that are not typically referred to. But there's a younger generation of artists who I wouldn't even classify as cartoonists, and nor would they. They're starting to see that it's important to find a different place to be completely honest. You know, magazines and newspapers have an editorial policy that you can't screw with. So they're looking to graphic novels, and they're looking to skateboards, you know, and walls on the street. And where a lot of people would assume that they're just tagging, that they're just graffiti artists, they're wrong. They're really well-informed young people out there doing really, really important work. And thank goodness for the internet. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's how I found them, and they're really, really great. So that's what I've learned, that it's not a lost cause. It's actually given me hope.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Mr. Fish, a.k.a. Dwayne Booth. I got to stop saying that, a.k.a. Aka. Yeah. Aka, Dwayne Booth, okay? And actually, Dwayne is, for people who don't know, Dwayne is the author of Go Fish, How to Win Contempt and Influence People. It always gets me. I can never get that, how to win contempt, because so rarely are people striving for contempt. But you've done it, okay, buddy?
Yeah.
But tell me this. You know, you also mentioned, and you imply in here now, that the point that there's, you know, magazines and newspapers and whatnot, they actually don't want you to do certain things. They don't want you to tell the truth a lot of times.
Right.
And there's a lot of suppression that goes on and repression. And there's things that, you know, broadly you can talk about that, but you also have some personal experience with that as well, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, as recently as the election of this last year.
The devil, you say?
Yeah, I mean, for leading up to the election, again, it happens constantly. I couldn't get my stuff in their usual places because people were very afraid that Romney was going to become president. As if, you know, shifting your editorial stance to be soft on Obama and attack Romney is what a democracy or what the First Amendment was for. You know, I mean, you should always rail against what you think is wrong. Don't give Obama a free ride. So, yes, I mean, I've had experience with having to argue that point with editors, and I seldom win. But my audience, I mean, the great thing about it is it's the audience is there, and they actually want voices like mine and voices like Chris Hedges and voices like other, you know, people who are out there who continue to bash on Obama, even though he's dashing.
Well, yeah, but boy, imagine what a difference it would have been if Romney was president. There would have been more wars. There would have been drones killing people all over the world. My God, they wouldn't have closed Guantanamo.
Hey, wait a minute.
Yeah, yeah, right. Okay. So, well, you know, there's other – I don't know. It's interesting to me too, because there's actually, you know – there's something that I remember you talking about this before. You actually – it gets very visceral with a lot of people, you know, if you actually tell the truth about things, because it's more than just telling the truth. And I've read some of the comments on your website, and I saw you replied to one of that. Huh?
Right.
What are you talking about? Yeah. But some of the comments on your website are provoked by, you know, some very, very really sharp art, the ones about the Palestinians and the Holocaust and mm-hmm. And right. the comparison of the two. Right. You know, the things that attack religion. These things, I would imagine, actually, this idea of, yes, the internet's really good, you know, in terms of being able to get your work out there. But there's also – there's a certain element of really – and like, for instance, I do have to say, and I'm going to mention this, and you can say, I'm not going to talk about that. And I'll say, he's censoring himself. But, you know, on your website, it had your cover story, your covers and all this stuff, and it had go to Harper's. And I went to Harper's, and it had, oops, problem here. Go back to the homepage. And I thought, Dwayne, what have you done?
I forced you into a brick wall, right?
That must have been heavy, actually, because Harper's is one of the magazines that actually prides itself on we give voice to the intellectual dissenters.
Yeah, not so much anymore.
Yeah,
that's interesting. Not so much. Yeah. They've changed, as so many other places have changed. And yeah, I've left the link up so people could go and get angry at the fact that it's a dead end. But what was the first part of that? Because you were saying something that I was going to respond to before you mentioned Harper's and got me all worked up.
I don't
No, we were talking about like, the honesty of art and so forth. And how it becomes a visceral thing for many people. Again, at least it starts the conversation and at least it shakes people up to know that they should be having a different conversation. Because if you're just going to let me just say it like this way. Aren't you tired of having to try to affect social change by trying to get it into the right inbox of the right congressperson? It's nonsense. I mean, how much longer are we going to have to ask for permission to save the human race from bureaucrats who are there for a different reason? They're power brokers for power. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a different thing. Just as an example, can you imagine Obama getting a tattoo? What if Obama went and got a tattoo, or he got an ear pierced, or if he grew a goatee? The fact that that would be impossible, that would never happen, because a lot of people would see that and see that it signaled the end of civilization somehow. I mean, in a really serious way. The fact that you can't have people in power and people that you can negotiate the direction of the democracy and the human race who are surrounded by a committee and an advertising industry that disallows that kind of honesty if somebody wanted to grow a mustache. You know, it would screw with the brand. So again, I'm just saying what cartoons do and what I try to do is find that personal place where you can have the conversation and feel like a friend. You know, you don't pull your punches with friends. Mm-hmm. You try to avoid the BS and you get down to the nitty-gritty and problems can actually be accessed and then solved.
Let me ask – we got time for one more question, and let me ask you this because, you know, one of the things I was thinking about when you said, well, what if Obama wanted to grow, you know, a mustache or have a tattoo or whatever, or an earring or whatever. Actually, you know what's really concerning is that, look, it's not far off. Those are accoutrements that are sort of widely acceptable. I mean, look, a lot of people in my family are like, you know, in Philadelphia, they're like, you know, they go to work in factories, they do this. They all got tattoos. My one nephew – is a tattoo artist. His father is a former lifer in the Navy. You know, these things are becoming, and not that he's not a rebel himself. He is, you know, the kid. Mm. But this is becoming acceptable. And the fact is, though, and this is what, and the point to this is that there's a whole strain of people that, as you were talking about, look, the liberals and conservatives, whatever, let's just talk about, look, the ruling class in this country, as generations age, those same people that are wearing earrings, have beards, have all this stuff, they're coming into – they are the standard in society. And the problem is that when people rely on this system as an outlet for – you know, as like expecting it to somehow give us expression, to enable us to express not just opposition but truth about what's the cause and what's the solution. And for me, you know, look, I'm wearing this T-shirt that says revolution, nothing less. That's what I'm trying to put out to the world all the time. And it's a fight to do that in a way that impacts society.
No, you're absolutely right. And that's the rub. And that's, I think, what the dominant culture and what the elite, the corporate elite have figured out is that if you can corporatize radicalism, then whoever is wearing that fashion will not be radicalized. Essentially, I think I brought this up on your show last time, watching The Daily Show and getting super angry and just being like, yeah, you know, we're actually being lied to. and people are being imprisoned, and there's lots of horrible things. People are being killed in drone attacks. You're sitting in your living room and you're becoming enraged. You're not doing anything political after that.
Mm-hmm. Although one would hope that actually your brain might tick a little bit and say, I got to get out in the street with my torch and my pitchfork and do something.
Right. So. I'm wearing a peace sign on my shirt, but I'm not doing anything to advance peace.
Yeah, let's hope that they can go beyond that. I'll tell you, that's a conversation we're going to have to – see, you always have to come back. Every time you come to L.A., you come back
on
the show.
That's a teaser.
Yeah, there you go. All right. We've been talking with Mr. Fish, a.k.a. Dwayne Booth, and we've been talking about political cartooning. Mr. Fish's cartoons appear on Truthdig and other blogs. He's also the author of Go Fish, How to Win Contempt and Influence People. Check out his work. I'm telling you, the cat is crazy and the work is amazing, all right? And you're really going to get a lot out of it. He's really very, very sharp insight into a lot of the most critical questions today in a way that makes your head snap around and makes you just laugh out loud and then step back and say, whoa, and realize how serious all this really is, all right? And once again, it's time to get the hell out of here. It's time to wrap up another show. And still got a whole lot more to say, and I'm one of those people that, like, if you don't shut them up, don't give them a time limit, I'm just going to keep on going, all right? Now, before we leave, you know, people who listen to this show know what its heart is, know what the show is about, what we're trying to do in the world. And oftentimes, people want to know how they can fit into all that. All right, so I want to read you an invitation from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. An invitation. Let's go on a crucial journey together, full of unity against oppression and lively struggle about the sources of the problem and the solution. Pursue your own convictions that the outrages that move you are intolerable to their logical conclusion, and be determined not to stop until those outrages have been eliminated. And if this, as well as learning about other outrages and ideas about how this all fits together and flows from a common source, and how it could all be ended and something much better brought into being, leads in the direction of seeing not only the need for bold and determined resistance, but also the need for revolution and ultimately communism, then don't turn away from that because it moves you beyond your comfort zone, challenges what had been your cherished beliefs, or because of prejudices and slanders. Instead, actively seek to learn more about this revolution and its goal of communism, and to determine whether it is in fact the necessary and possible solution, and then act accordingly. Once again, that's from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And you can check out more of Avakian's work and learn more about this movement for revolution by going to revcom.us. That's R-E-V as in Victor, C-O-M.us. You've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my engineer for today, Teddy Robinson, and all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And if you want to follow me, although not in a creepy way, you can do so on Facebook and Twitter. Okay? All right, we're going to go out now with a song from a woman named Iris Dement. And that song is Wasteland of the Free.
Living in the wasteland of the free. We got preachers dealing in politics and